Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Robert F. Kennedy, and what did he have that made him a national symbol of America's yearning for equality after less than 3 months of campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination of 1968? The one-time Attorney General under John Fitzgerald Kennedy was a 42-year-old first-time senator when he decided, with difficulty, to run for the nomination. He had a lot stacked against him, including an incumbent Democrat in the White House and a reputation for a volatile temper. But Robert Kennedy's passion for racial and economic justice and the honesty of his confrontational style quickly won support, or at least respect, from all over the country, which is one reason his death came as such a blow to a nation still healing from the assassination of John Kennedy and still reeling from the murder of Martin Luther King. Thurston Clark's new book chronicles RFK's remarkable bid for the nomination through the eyes of those who witnessed it firsthand. It's called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Thurston, welcome to Think. Hi, Thurston. Welcome to Think.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on.
Kennedy took a long time to throw his hat into the ring. Can you talk about what his biggest concerns were about running?
Yes. He was worried that his candidacy would be seen as a continuation of the well-known personal feud between him and Lyndon Johnson, and he didn't want that to happen. He'd become opposed to the war in Vietnam. He had very serious differences with Johnson about the response to the inner-city riots of 1967, and he was afraid people would say, oh, well, Kennedy's doing this because he hates Johnson. He was also concerned that he wouldn't win and that he would completely turn the Democratic political establishment against him, so he wouldn't be able to get the nomination in 1972. We have to remember that it was the bosses and the party establishment that really chose the nominee in 1968, and the primaries weren't that important.
And so he had Ethel Kennedy, his wife, pushing him to do this, to try it. And meanwhile, Ted Kennedy, his brother, was doing everything in his power to discourage RFK's run.
That's right. Ethel, who knew him better than anyone, knew that he would lose all respect for himself and that he wouldn't be able to live with himself if he didn't run. Ted, which he's kind of acknowledged over the years, was worried that he would the same thing would happen to him as happened to JFK. But Ted also thought it was an unwise political decision that it was impossible to win the nomination from Johnson. What had happened, really, is that Kennedy had kind of, what I call, painted himself into a moral corner on Vietnam. He'd condemned the Vietnam War not just as a strategic blunder or something that wasn't in the best interest of American security, but as a moral, as an immoral war. And once he did that, it became very hard for him to support Johnson. People said to him, if you feel this way, how can you support Lyndon Johnson? And, of course, there was no answer to that question.
And Kennedy, of course, was then forced to acknowledge his own role in making that all happen in the first place.
Oh, of course. He was very upfront about that. He'd started questioning the war after Johnson escalated it in 1965, and particularly the bombing of North Vietnam had distressed Kennedy. And, in fact, the first speech of his campaign at Kansas State in March, after he told the students, look, I'm as responsible for this as anybody. I have not just responsibility of my brother's administration, but I'm personally responsible for this. And then he went on to talk about how, you know, people who don't admit their faults can't learn and can't change direction.
And one thing that it's easy to forget now is that you did, in fact, have Johnson still in the race at the time that Kennedy announced that he would go in. But then finally he said that he would not take the nomination, he would not seek the nomination. How did that change things in the Kennedy camp?
Yeah, he only ran against Johnson for 2 weeks. And it wasn't just Johnson pulling out, but when Johnson pulled out on March 31st, announced he wouldn't be a candidate for re-election, he also announced a bombing halt of North Vietnam and that he was going to enter into peace negotiations with the communists, with the North and with the communists fighting in the South. These were things that Kennedy had been advocating, so that really in a stroke, Kennedy lost his two big issues, at least the two things he'd made his issues in the previous 2 weeks. And one was, of course, the unpopular war and the unpopular president who was waging it. Now, b- Before he ran, Kennedy told some friends, you know, this campaign should really be about racial inequality and economic inequality in this country, and that's the real; those are the real issues. And there were these strange 4 days from when Johnson said 31st of March that he wasn't going to run until Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4th. And there was this moment of great national happiness. I mean, everybody, not everybody who opposed the war, even people who still supported the war, they weren't for Johnson either, really. There were very few people who really supported Johnson then. And it seemed that the American political system was working. Johnson had pulled out, and then, of course, King is assassinated. But during that period, Kennedy realized that he could now make this campaign about what he wanted to make it about, which was the problems of the inner cities and race and poverty.
He was only 34 years old when he became Attorney General under the John F. Kennedy administration, which is extraordinary when you think about it. During that time, he did an effective job, but also gained this reputation for being sort of a hothead and incredibly emotional. Mm-hmm. And he made some mistakes there that could have really haunted him politically. Can you talk about the biggest ones?
Yeah, well, there were a number. One, he approved the wiretaps on Martin Luther King's phones because he believed that two of his close associates were active communists. He also, at the beginning of his brother's administration, he was somewhat lukewarm on the whole issue of civil rights, that he wasn't as active as Dr. King and others in the movement would have liked, nor was his brother. It was a time of great tension in the Cold War. A couple of months when his brother first became president, the winter and spring of 61, he was preparing for a summit with Khrushchev, and that was a time when there were a lot of new African countries in the UN. And it was felt that these demonstrations, particularly the Freedom Riders, were going to give the United States a black eye at the UN and make Kennedy's negotiating with Khrushchev more difficult. But Kennedy later came around on civil rights. By 63, he was really a hero to the movement. I mean, he was vigorously enforcing school integration. And behind his brothers, supported his brother, who gave this the fabulous, very famous speech in June of 63, in which he put the whole issue of civil rights as a moral problem. So he did come around, but definitely the King wiretaps, and of course earlier, as I say in my book, this man was no saint. He'd been a very hard-bitten and ruthless, and that's where he got the name, the adjective for being ruthless, manager of his brother's campaign in 1960. He'd worked for Joe McCarthy, etc.
And he never denounced the work that he did for McCarthy.
He never did. He moved away from it. He was only with McCarthy, I think it was 6 or 9 months or something, very short period of time. McCarthy had been a family friend and was close to his father, and I think it was hard for Bobby to do that. In a way, it was repudiating his father as well.
Can you talk about how he really got to know, as he developed an interest in issues of equality and particularly racial equality, how did he really develop relationships within the Native American and African American and Latino communities?
What he did was he went to these, he experienced these things himself. He didn't just give speeches on the floor of the Senate. He would hold hearings. Particularly, he started a subcommittee on Indian education. He made that his issue. And he went around the country to a number of Indian reservations himself and held hearings. Back in the 60s and when he was early 60s and when he was a senator, he started the Bedford-Stuyvesant redevelopment organization in Brooklyn, in a bad inner city neighborhood then, and which was a partnership between local people and private industry. In other words, he went to Mississippi. He saw starvation. He picked up a starving child in his arms. I mean, this was someone who lived through experience. I mean, people call him an existential politician. I mean, he was constantly changed by what he was experiencing. And then he felt he had a responsibility to bring these experiences to the American people. And that's why his campaign in 68 had a huge kind of educational component to it, where he would be telling suburban housewives in Indiana about people on Indian reservations and people starving in Mississippi, things that they'd had no experience with whatsoever.
Thurston Clark is my guest. His book is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. He came home from one of those trips to Mississippi and told his own kids, he had 10 at the time and ultimately 11, do you have any idea how lucky you are?
Yeah, he was, but he wasn't really attacking them, and he'd done similar things like this before. But yes, he was. I think that the Mississippi trip, which was in April of '67, was probably the second most important event of the 1960s for him. The first, of course, with his brother's assassination, but this was another absolutely stunning event that afterwards he couldn't stop talking about it. He brought it up again and again in speeches throughout the campaign and even before the campaign. The day after he'd been to Mississippi and he came back and he saw his children eating dinner and he said, "You don't know how lucky you are. Do something for your country." He then went into the Department of Agriculture, persuaded them to stop charging people for food stamps, because at the time you had to have a little bit of money to get food stamps, and the sharecroppers had been thrown out of work in Mississippi, didn't have a penny to buy food stamps with. Then he goes to New York City. He goes to visit Carter Burden, who was one of his Senate aides. Amanda Burden, Carter's wife, opens the door, and he looks at her, and he says, "You don't know what I've seen. You don't know what I've seen." And then he pauses, and he said, "Everything I've done so far is worthless." In other words, given, you know, that this was happening in the country, everything he'd done, you know, didn't seem to matter to him. Of course, he had a big soft spot for children, and he was touched by the suffering of children more so than by suffering of any other class or group of people, and that went across racial lines.
We should point out, on the other hand, that he was not a fan of traditional sort of on-the-dole welfare programs as a solution to poverty. What did he want to do for Americans who were suffering economically?
Well, he saw the federal government not, first of all, there's this misconception that he didn't want the federal government to have any part or any kind of active role in any kind of anti-poverty programs, but that wasn't true. He saw them as an employer of last resort, and he did feel that there should be federal funds going to anti-poverty programs. His quarrel was with the way that these were administrated, and the fact that the local people and local organizations under Johnson's war on poverty had very little input. They had no control. Everything was being done from Washington. Local people had no power. And this is one of the things that he objected to. He also wanted to bring in and harness private industry through enterprise zones and tax cuts and things which Clinton and other Democrats have later, you know, have also supported. He was really ahead of his time on that. He wasn't a kind of libertarian about this at all, but he did want local control and local power over the anti-poverty programs.
He certainly had a complex relationship to his brother. Can you talk about how bothered he was by the sort of shadow that was cast over his own career by John F. Kennedy?
Well, at first, I don't think he was bothered at all. During his campaign for the U.S. Senate, he said that he was running to, you know, fulfill his brother's, so the hopes his brother kindled would not die, I think was the one expression that he used. And when he started campaigning for the president, he did, the first couple of speeches, mention his brother. He was quite nervous, and I think he felt he needed this. But slowly, in the weeks as the campaign moved on, he realized a couple of things. One was that the crowds had come for him and not for his brother. And the other was that the answers that his brother had offered in the New Frontier were not the right answers for 1968.
Thurston Clark is my guest. We're talking about his book, The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. After the break, we'll talk about what happened in the Kennedy campaign upon the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Thurston Clark. His new book is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Thurston, you have LBJ pulling out of the race on March 31st, 5 days later. Just as the Kennedy campaign is sort of responding to that, Martin Luther King is assassinated.
Right. And not only that, the day that he's assassinated is the day that Robert Kennedy is launching his campaign in Indiana, the first state he was running in a primary in, very important primary for him. And he delivers two speeches at Notre Dame and at Ball State, and as he's in his plane from Ball State to Indianapolis, before he gets on the plane, he learns that King's been shot. When he lands in Indianapolis, where he has a rally scheduled in an inner-city neighborhood, he learns that King is dead. The police chief is there to meet him, and he tells him not to go, that it's too dangerous, that he can't be protected. Kennedy refuses. He says that he'll be perfectly safe. They have quite a kind of an angry exchange on the tarmac. And Kennedy goes ahead, and he arrives at 17th and Broadway. There's an outdoor basketball court. There's a flatbed truck. There's about 3,000 people in the crowd. About two-thirds of them don't know that King is dead. And another third on the outer circle have just learned it and have come out. Some of them are armed. Race relations in Indianapolis were very poor at that point in 1968, one of the tenser northern cities. And they're armed with Molotov cocktails and guns. And Kennedy walks up onto the platform. And the first thing he says to one of the organizers is, do they know about Dr. King? And the man says, well, not exactly. We've left that to you. And so it is up to Kennedy then to begin his speech by announcing that King has been shot. And there's wails and great cries of despair. And then he delivers a completely extemporaneous seven-minute speech that some people think is the best speech he ever delivered. That he made up on the spot.
And what did he say?
Well, he did a couple of things in that speech, which are really interesting. The first thing he did was that he mentioned his brother's assassination in public for the first time since his brother had been assassinated. I can just read you the sentence. He said, "For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel, in my own heart, that same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed. He was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond, to go beyond these rather difficult times." And then he follows that by quoting Aeschylus. Now, after JFK's assassination, he was in deep despair for months and months. And one of the things that comforted him was reading the Greeks. And he memorized a number of the passages that were particularly telling, and he then delivers to this audience, gives them the gift of one of these passages. And he then goes on to say, "My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus, and he once wrote, quote, 'Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God.'" And then he goes on to speak for another couple of minutes. And then he ends the speech by saying, "Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people." And then he leaves, and after that, there are no riots in Indianapolis. They just go home. And it's one of the only major cities in the United States that is not struck by violence that night.
And the book that he quoted from was given to him by Jackie Kennedy.
That's correct. It was, yes. He got interested in the Greeks through Edith Hamilton, who had written a book about the Greek, about Greek philosophers. And then he went on from there to read more and memorize passages.
At several points in the book, people who knew Robert Kennedy report having been shocked to see him on the campaign trail looking frail and exhausted and sick at a couple of points. Can you talk about the pace of the campaign?
Well, it was punishing, and the reason it was so punishing was that he needed contact with large crowds. He didn't necessarily enjoy it, but he realized he needed it. He got energy from it. One of his aides, Fred Dutton, told me that the crowds revived him like a couple of drinks, that he would be exhausted and everything, and then he'd turn the corner and there'd be a couple of thousand people, and he would just gain energy. The other thing is that he learned from people's expressions. He was constantly looking at people's faces as he spoke. He was reading the signs. It was a way he got feedback. And finally, he believed that he had a duty to do this. He had a believed that politicians had a duty to go to before the people. There were constant debates in his campaign about whether he should campaign more from a television studio. He realized he was not very good at television. He didn't come across well on television. He came across very well in public. And he felt that he needed to commune with people, that people had to get at him. Two things he said I thought were important. Once he told somebody who said, you know, you're taking terrible risks by, you know, exposing yourself like this. He said, well, so many people hate me that I've got to let the people who love me get at me. And which was very, because he did have, he had people who hated him even more bitterly than they'd hated JFK. And the other thing he said was, you know, the people can watch a politician on television. They can read his speeches and read about it. He said, and they can see him in a crowd, but it's the touching they'll never forget. If they can touch you, they'll never forget it. And that's why he exposed himself to these extraordinary motorcades. And the longest political motorcade in American history probably happened, a 9-hour motorcade across northern Indiana on the last day of the Indiana primary. Just an unbelievable event.
And he was never unaware that there was a risk that he could be shot. It wasn't like he was in denial of this fact. It was something that spooked him.
No, it spooked him. It doesn't mean it doesn't mean he wasn't courageous, but you can be afraid and also be courageous. And I think he was both. There is enough. He would say, or flippantly, people would say, people he didn't know very well would say something about, well, aren't you taking a terrible risk? Or, you know, aren't you worried? And he'd say, well, you can't worry about those things. What happens, happens, and everything else. But that kind of, there were moments when he kind of revealed himself a little bit more. Several times there were firecrackers, a party popper, a balloon went off, and the reflexive way that he reacted to those made it clear that he, for a split second, he thought that someone was shooting him. He made some comments to people. He told the writer Romain Gary a few weeks before he was killed that he thought there would be an assassination attempt on his life. He said not so much out of political hatred, but just through emulation. In other words, emulating the JFK and Martin Luther King assassinations. And a couple of days after King's assassination, he was walking through the riot zone in Washington with Reverend Walter Fauntroy, who'd been close to King and was also a friend of his. And Fauntroy said to him, how's the campaign going? And Kennedy went through this litany about, well, if I win Indiana and if I win Nebraska, then I think I can win over Mayor Daley, etc. And then he stopped. And he looked at Fauntroy and he said, but there's only one problem. And Fauntroy said, well, what's that, Bobby? And he said, I think there are guns between me and the White House. Well, this was so contrary to what Fauntroy had heard from him before and so out of character for him to voice these fears that Fauntroy kind of pushed him and said, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean about guns? And what is there a specific plot? And then Kennedy, realizing that he'd kind of revealed himself, immediately clammed up. He said, I didn't mean anything, nothing, shook his head. Fauntroy pushed him and pushed him more. In fact, Fauntroy was so concerned that he missed the first part of his second Palm Sunday service while he was talking to Bobby, and Kennedy just clammed up and wouldn't say anything more.
Bobby Kennedy had always been a guy who was easily thrown into a rage. He'd always cried easily. Is there any reason to believe, Thurston, that had he actually survived and won the election, that he might not have been physically and emotionally strong enough to handle the job?
I think he was physically very strong. I think there's no doubt that physically he could do it. I mean, he campaigned at this incredible pace. He finally collapsed on the last appearance on the last day of the California primary. We had to sit down on the edge of a stage. I think his physical stamina was extraordinary. I don't think that's the problem. And the same thing, I think he was very disciplined mentally. I think emotionally. I think, though, that his emotions were close to the surface. And that's, you know, there. That is a question. I know that after King's assassination and after he'd given the speech that we talked about a few minutes ago, He broke down twice in the hotel afterwards, weeping on a bed. No one's quite sure who he was crying for, whether it was for King or for his brother, because, of course, the King's assassination reminded him of JFK, or whether he was worried about himself. I mean, he went to the door of one of his campaign workers and said to her, "Joni, it could have been me." So, yes, I think you're right. This was a man who felt things deeply. He did cry. He cried particularly when he was witnessed poverty and suffering. There are a number of instances of that. We don't know what kind of a president he would be. We know what kind of a president JFK was and have a good idea of what he would have done in his second term, certainly a better idea, but we just simply don't know. We don't even know how Bobby Kennedy ran in the would have run in a general election, of course.
Let's talk about the personal similarities and differences between the two brothers, because certainly they had a lot of convictions in common, but they were not the same man. Can you compare and contrast for us?
Yeah, not at all. The style of campaigning was completely different. JFK was, of course, was cool. He was very removed. He was not someone who put his emotions out there. He almost never talked about his family. He would joke, but it was not the same kind of corny, kind of self-deprecating humor that Bobby Kennedy had. Bobby Kennedy was very emotional. He talked about his family all the time. He brought his family along and brought his kids on the campaign tour with him. There was a vulnerability about Kennedy, about Bobby Kennedy, that was different from his brothers. I mean, I had women, a couple of women who've been in audiences and another that I read in transcripts saying, "He looked so vulnerable, I just wanted to go up there and hug him." I mean, I don't think people, you know, felt quite that way about JFK. The other thing about Bobby was that he worked, he campaigned at what Sander Van Oker, the NBC cameraman, correspondent, said was a, quote, constant state of outrage. He was outraged about the Vietnam War. He was outraged about poverty. He was outraged about hunger. And that's a different kind of campaigning than JFK did. You wouldn't say that JFK was outraged by these things. So there's a difference. There's a real difference there.
One of the things that outraged him specifically about Vietnam, in addition to our presence there, was the draft deferrals that were available for people who were in college and therefore presumably of a certain economic standard, and not for other people.
Yeah, this happened again and again, that he would go to a college campus, he'd get a great reception, he'd deliver a prepared speech. And I should just add that he was not, unlike JFK, he wasn't very good at delivering prepared speeches, but he was excellent at question and answer. And often someone would ask him about deferments, and he would say, "I'm against them," and for just the reasons you cited, that it was unfair, that why should a rich boy escape fighting in Vietnam and the poor boys go and die in your stead? And there would sometimes be boos and catcalls, and he would just hold his ground and argue with people for 15 minutes or so on this subject. But it wasn't just Vietnam. It was all kinds of areas. I mean, he went and spoke to a bunch of aerospace workers out in California and told them that we should slow down the race to the moon, that it was more important to make our inner cities safe so that people could walk on their streets. He went to West Virginia, and he was had a white audience, a blue-collar white audience, and he told them that why didn't they start by clearing up the wrecked cars that were sitting in their hollows and in their stream beds, and why wait for the government to do that? Again and again, he was what we call a reverse demagogue. He told people the opposite of what they wanted to hear.
It's amazing that people still sort of went back to him after this. It almost seems that he was, every single place he went, deliberately baiting people.
Well, that's right. But I think that at least in 1968, this hasn't been tested this year, of course, in the same way, people appreciated courage. And people, even the former supporters of current supporters then of Governor George Wallace, who'd been the former segregationist governor of Alabama, who'd run as for the Democrat in 64 and ran as an independent in 68, they appreciated this. There was something of the tough Irish cop about Bobby Kennedy that translated with blue-collar whites. There was also, as I said, there was an appreciation for the man's courage. You could see his courage every single day, going out in open cars after what had happened to his brother, going into crowds unprotected. That was courage. That was physical courage. The moral courage was to tell people these uncomfortable truths.
So you mentioned earlier that the primaries were not quite as important back then as they are today, and I know polls weren't exactly what they are today. But was he ever at the front of the pack, even for the Democratic nomination?
Well, he would. He. You know, it depends. It's hard to say because at the time that he was shot, Hubert Humphrey had theoretically Humphrey had joined the campaign. He'd been Johnson's vice president. He joined the end of April. Was not running in a single primary, and he had more delegates than Kennedy did. But the feeling was, and my feeling is definitely after talking to people who were close to Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, who was really the kingmaker that year, the convention was being held in his city. He controlled the Illinois delegation. The other bosses looked to him, is that he was going to swing to Bobby Kennedy. He didn't like Humphrey. And once Johnson was out, he was really looking for an excuse to back Bobby Kennedy. And I think that the Kennedy's victory in both California and the same night in South Dakota, which was Humphrey's home state where he'd been born, and there was a very energetic write-in vote for Humphrey there, would have brought him the nomination.
Hours before his life ended, he told somebody that he felt like he had finally shaken off the shadow of John F. Kennedy from his own political career.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of told him that had happened?
I think a couple of things. I think he was really speaking about his own. I think he was speaking about his own self-confidence and the fact that he was appealing to the passion among the minorities and poor Americans for him was even greater than it was for JFK. It was a different. He was appealing to a different, not just a different kind of audience, but the depth of the passion was so much deeper. Cesar Chavez said, for every one man, he was the head of the farm workers in California, for every one of his people who were Mexican-Americans who were working for JFK, we had 50 working for Bobby.
My guest is Thurston Clark. His book is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. You can get online to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Thurston Clark. His new book is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Let's talk about what happened on the day that he was to appear at the Ambassador Hotel.
This was, as I mentioned before, the day before he'd had one of the most punishing days of the campaign. He campaigned in San Francisco and Los Angeles and ended up in San Diego where he collapsed. He spent the day at the Malibu Beach house of Director John Frankenheimer, who was a family friend. At one point, there Richard Goodwin, who'd been writing speeches for him, came and he saw Kennedy just collapsed on this lounge chair. And for an awful minute, he thought he was dead. Then he realized that he wasn't. It was just after JFK, everybody was so worried that something was going to happen to Bobby. He was so exhausted that he announced that he wasn't going to go to the Ambassador Hotel and ordered extra television sets brought into Frankenheimer's house so that his close aides and he could watch the results there, and he wouldn't have to go to all the craziness of the hotel. But the networks objected. They wanted him there. They had their correspondents there. They wanted to do interviews. They thought he was going to win. Their polls were showing him ahead. So he finally gave in and went to the hotel. And when he got there, he was there upstairs in his suite for a couple of hours. They had delays with the returns from Los Angeles. They had new voting machines, and actually there was the whole punch card problem that we had in Florida back in 2000. again, and it delayed the returns until finally 10:30 or 11. It finally became, I think, around 10:30, 10:45, it became clear he was going to win. He did some interviews, and then he went down to the ballroom to announce this to his supporters, who were in a state of frenzy because, of course, they'd been there for hours and hours waiting for this. Now, when Kennedy left a ballroom or left an auditorium, he was absolutely insistent that he didn't go out the back way. He wouldn't go out through the exit, he told his. In fact, he chewed out his aide several times who tried to hustle him from the stage out the back way so he wouldn't be mauled by the crowd. He said, no, we always go through the crowd. We always go through the crowd. This is the only time he made an exception. Nobody's quite sure why. In fact, his bodyguard, he had one unarmed bodyguard, who was a former FBI agent, Bill Barry, was, and Fred Dutton, his campaign manager, were heading out through the crowd, making a path for him. And Kennedy allowed himself to be led by an assistant hotel manager back the way he'd come in, back through the pantry and through the kitchen. Some people think it's because, he was tired, and he just didn't want to be mauled by the crowd again, and also he was eager to go to a press conference for print reporters that was being held in a room very close to the kitchen, and then he wanted to go on to a party and a discotheque. And so it was a complete break with tradition, and he went back through the pantry, and of course that's where Sirhan happened to be waiting.
And you talked about him on his way to a press conference. In fact, he was speaking with a radio reporter, a guy named Andrew West, when
right.
he was shot.
Well, yeah, Andrew West was broadcasting, and he'd asked him a few questions. And so you have this very immediate tape. I mean, the interesting thing about the Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's assassination, is very unlike JFK's. JFK, of course, as we know, was shot at a high-powered rifle from a great distance and was in a car with his wife and a few other people. Governor Connally of Texas. Bobby was in a small room surrounded by 80 people. Other people were wounded. They grabbed the gun out of Sirhan's hand. It was a completely different situation. There were photographers there. The most famous photograph was taken by Bill Eppridge of life, of Bobby on the floor with the busboy next to him. So it was recorded. It was photographed. It was, it was immediate. It was horrifying. I say in the book he was killed almost like a farm animal in a kind of abattoir. I mean, the kitchen with the knives and the stainless steel tables and the floor. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible experience for those who've never forgotten, for those who were in that room with him.
You know, it's tempting to make too much of this and create a metaphor where maybe none exists, but it is interesting if you look at the sort of the distance from which John Kennedy was shot and the remoteness of his killer, and then the style that Bobby Kennedy had, which was so much closer and being really interested in getting close to people, and that's
yeah.
the way he died.
Yeah, that is, I hadn't thought of that before. That's very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah, that's certainly true.
And Sirhan was just a disturbed guy. Is that
well?
I mean, there
yeah.
are conspiracy theories, of course.
There are endless conspiracy theories. You know, my book is about the campaign, and I wanted to stay away from all of that. And I didn't go into it. I read a couple of the standard books about about the assassination and the conspiracy theories and everything else. And I'm not persuaded. One reason, there was just so many witnesses there. The whole idea that Sirhan was some kind of Manchurian candidate programmed by the mob or by Aristotle Onassis or by all these people, I don't think it holds water because of the weapon he used, which was a .22, which was a pop gun, and it wasn't even though he was quite close to Kennedy, the doctors said afterwards that if it had just been a millimeter here or there, Kennedy would have survived. So you don't go to all the expense of hiring an assassin and programming him and everything else and then give him a .22. To do the job, and also there was no way Sirhan knew that Kennedy was going to come back through the kitchen. There's some theories that a guard there had something to do with it, and I just don't think that holds up because there's so many eyewitnesses there, and none of them mentioned that.
One of the most poignant things about the assassination, as you write it, is that nobody was shocked by it, including Kennedy himself.
Yeah, nobody was shocked. In fact, the reporters who covered him, a lot of them had been told by their editors, and particularly the television cameramen, never to leave Kennedy's side. And there was a lot of black humor of, you don't want to miss it when it happens. Hmm. And so the campaign, for some of the reporters, they felt that they were on the term death watch was used. Another used the term watching a slow-motion suicide. the first day of the campaign in Kansas, after he'd gotten this wonderful reception at Kansas State and the University of Kansas, reporters sit around a table in a restaurant on the way to the airport, and Jimmy Breslin says, then of the Daily News, says, well, do you think this guy has the stuff to go all the way? And the Newsweek reporter, John J. Lindsay, says, sure, he has the stuff to go all the way, but he's not going to go all the way. And the reason is that someone's going to shoot him. And you know it, and I know it, and we all know it. Just as we're sitting here, someone's going to shoot him. And all the reporters agreed that someone's going to shoot him. Now, whether they were going to kill him or not, but they thought the assumption was that there was going to be an assassination attempt.
How did that assumption, not only on the part of people in the media and analysts, but of a lot of members of the American public, how did that affect the way people coped with it?
You mean after it happened?
Yeah.
The reaction to Kennedy's death was both more emotional, long-term emotional, I think, deeper than the one even to JFK and Martin Luther King, because he was not because he was any greater a politician or a man or a charismatic leader than those two, but because it was the third one and he was the last one. And people didn't see anybody else after him. You know, after JFK, there was RFK. After King was assassinated, King's supporters, the night of his funeral, more or less told Bobby Kennedy they were putting their hopes in him, and he was their last hope. And so Kennedy had assumed the mantle of these two assassinated leaders. And so when he was gone, it was absolutely shocking. And people were also a bit numb by then. You'd had the King assassination 2 months earlier. You know, at the time, it was assumed by the Army, by the National Guard in California, and by the Pentagon, that there were going to be major riots that would break out in American cities if Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, that would be similar to the ones following King's assassination because he was so popular with African Americans. It didn't happen, and some of the African American leaders afterwards were very perplexed by this, and they came up almost apologetically with excuses for why the ghettos hadn't exploded for Bobby. Of course, the great tribute to him was the 2 million people who spontaneously lined the tracks of the funeral train taking his corpse from New York to Washington.
And they had to actually slow the train down, finally.
Well, there was a terrible accident in Trenton. In Elizabeth, and a couple of people were killed who had pushed onto the tracks. So they slowed it to half speed, and it took about 9 hours. And it was an amazing demonstration of grief and love. The people in the train just looked out the window, and they saw the sorrow reflected on the faces of Americans of all kind of race and economic background. I think the extraordinary thing is, if you look at the photos, that so many people felt the best way to honor someone who had bitterly opposed an American war by then was to put on a uniform and wave a flag.
Given the similarities that we have today, especially with the situation of a now unpopular president fighting a very unpopular war, there are all these comparisons made between Robert Kennedy and Barack Obama. What do you make of those?
Well, I think that the comparison, they both have energized the young. They have both offered the hope that of ending the war and better days, and what
first
Robert Kennedy senators called the wound to the national soul, that this wound can be healed. But they're quite different. Going back to what we talked about JFK and RFK and the differences between them, really, in style and campaign style, I think Obama reminds me more of JFK than Bobby Kennedy. And there's also the question of the American people and what they will tolerate and take and what kind of criticism they'll take from a candidate. You know, listen, look what happened to Michelle Obama when she made her comment about, you know, she was proud of her country for the first time, whatever she said. Consider some of the things that Bobby Kennedy told while he was running for president. He told the American, and meet the press, he said, I'm dissatisfied with our society. I suppose I'm dissatisfied with my country. He wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. He said, once we thought with Jefferson we were the best hope of all mankind, but now we seem to rely only on our wealth and power. And finally, in a speech in Stockton, California, a week after he announced, he said, America had once been a country that stood for decency and for justice and for confidence and hope, but now sometimes it seems we've become something else. Anybody who said that today would be slaughtered. It would be political suicide to make statements like that.
Yeah, how is it that we've sanitized politics so much in the wake of a career that we look at now as very inspirational?
Well, I don't know. I have some theories, and I've had some people offer me some theories. You know, maybe it started with that famous malaise speech that Jimmy Carter gave back in the 70s after the oil crisis, in which I believe he never used the word malaise. I think maybe it's after Ronald Reagan's Morning in America presidency, it's become impossible for a politician to ever say a discouraging word about the American people, to criticize the American people. You know, we talk a lot about Kennedy and others and brave politicians speaking truth to power. Well, you know, in an election, the electorate has the power. They have the power to elect somebody. And the question is, who's going to dare speak truth to that power? It certainly isn't happening this year.
Thurston, did Bobby Kennedy change America, or did he simply go as far as showing those who survived him the ways that it might be changed?
The latter. Mm-hmm. I don't think he changed. I think he left his campaign leftist with an example. I call it a template for how a candidate could run for president in a time of moral crisis, a time pretty much fairly similar to the one we find ourselves in now.
Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in looking back at him, and you certainly don't do this in the book, I don't think, but yeah, over-romanticizing who Bobby Kennedy was?
Yeah, there is. That was a real problem for me because, look, these were 82 days when this was a politician, a man who was at his best. As I say in the beginning, he wasn't a saint. There were things he did that I don't think he was proud of that no one should be. But these were 82 days when he was at his best. So, yes, there is that problem. If you take this is a campaign biography, and there is that problem. And just to go back to, Barack Obama now running, of course, it's kind of unfair to make some comparisons to him to Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby Kennedy never ran in a general election. So we don't know how much he would have moved to the center. We don't know if the truth-telling that he did during the primary would have continued into the general election or not. So it's hard to make the comparison between Barack Obama and Kennedy. Certainly, if you want to look at the similarities, it's the hope and the ability to inspire the young. And Barack Obama is the first person who's been able to do this since Bobby Kennedy.
Do you try to avoid speculating how America would have been different if Kennedy had been president?
Well, I do, but there are a couple of things I could say. One thing I can say for sure, and that is that if he'd won the nomination, which I think he would have, there wouldn't have been the riots in Chicago. I don't think it would have happened, or at least on the same scale. And if that hadn't happened, I think the Democratic Party would be in a much better situation. For 40 years, that's been an albatross around it.
Thurston Clark's new book is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Such interesting writing, Thurston. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.